Is a global trade war brewing? From Marketplace in New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson in for David Brancaccio. Over the weekend, President Trump suggested via Twitter that he could slap a tax on European cars sold in the U.S. It started last week when the president said the U.S. will levy tariffs on imports of steel and aluminum to protect domestic producers. EU officials promised to respond with tariffs of their own on iconic American car products like bourbon, blue jeans, Harley-Davidson motorcycles. Here with us to discuss is Ian Bremmer. He's the founder of the Eurasia Group, a global risk consultancy. So, Ian, what are you telling clients about the possibility of a trade war?
Well, first, I'm telling them that the level of follow-through and consistency from Trump, given history of tweets, is less than consistent. But there's no question that this is an issue that Trump has been consistent on. He's been looking for reasons to put tariffs more broadly against countries that the United States has deficits with. And so absolutely, this is going to be a market negative.
But at the same time that we heard President Trump tweeting about these new taxes on cars from Europe, we also heard from a Trump advisor who said that while countries won't be excluded from these tariffs, some companies could apply for an exemption. Does that ease your concern at all?
There were actual conversations between Trump's trade team and the Canadians and the Mexicans in the last couple of weeks where they were privately told that specifically friendly countries would be excluded from these tariffs, and that's now changed. So there's enormous inconsistency. Companies aren't the ones that decide on trade policy internationally. Countries do. So the fact that Trump or some of Trump's team might be talking about, well, there's some companies that are friendly that might not get the same treatment, is not really going to change the attitude we see politically from the European Union or from other countries around the world that would be negatively affected by the imposition of these tariffs.
What are you expecting in terms of reactions from China, from other trading partners?
The good news is the Chinese have expected this. I've sat down with Chinese officials in the past couple of months, and they absolutely have been prepared for specifically these steel and aluminum measures. And the response to Chinese don't want a trade war is going to be very carefully calibrated. With allies, it is more problematic because they've all been concerned that the Trump administration doesn't support multilateral trade. He pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And so, you know, you have allies all over the world that have already been hedging away from the United States and moving towards both self-reliance and other countries like the Chinese who are writing checks.
Ian Bremmer with the Eurasia Group. Thanks for chatting.
My pleasure.
Last night, Frances McDormand won the Best Actress Oscar for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. In her acceptance speech, she encouraged studio executives to finance projects directed by and starring women. And then she said this.
I have two words to leave with you tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Inclusion rider.
An inclusion rider. It's not often you hear talk of contractual obligations in an award show speech. Marketplace's Marielle Segura is here to explain.
So an inclusion rider is a clause in a movie contract. It says the demographics of the film's cast and crew have to match those of the U.S. population, specifically when it comes to race, gender, sexual orientation, and disability. And the idea for these clauses has been around for a couple years. It came from researchers at the University of Southern California. They found a persistent diversity gap in U.S. films. And their thinking was that A-list actors like Frances McDormand could help close that gap. They have a lot of power in contract negotiations and could use it to demand this kind of language. The clauses could be written so they apply only to non-starring roles where casting wouldn't interfere with the plot of the movie. The researchers are also trying to get states to offer tax breaks for studios that use these.
Marketplace's Marielle Segura, thanks. In January, the Trump administration announced it would end a program that had allowed some 200,000 Salvadorans to live in the U.S. since at least 2001. Temporary protective status is meant to give provisional residency to people whose home nation is deemed unsafe. The Trump administration says El Salvador no longer qualifies. But as Levi Bridges reports from El Salvador, the situation there is still pushing some people to consider crossing into the U.S. illegally.
Many businesses here in San Salvador get extorted by gangs. The country's central bank estimates that Salvadorans spend $756 million in extortion fees every year. Gangs kill people who don't pay up. Plus, there aren't many economic opportunities either, says 32-year-old Francisco Vasquez. That's why many Salvadorans, like him, try to go to the U.S. Vasquez says whole families flee El Salvador. Central Americans pay smugglers up to $10,000 to take them to the U.S. Vasquez and his three brothers tried going to Arizona without a smuggler last year to find work as undocumented immigrants. They traveled on top of trains in Mexico, but Vasquez's little brother, Marvin, fell off a train in northern Mexico and died. We did everything we could to save him, Vasquez says, but there was nothing we could do. Central Americans take dangerous risks to reach the U.S. Carlos Carcach is a professor at San Salvador's Higher School of Economics and Business. He says El Salvador has to find new ways to create jobs.
We might even have to legalize drugs here.
Legalizing drugs is a sort of creative disruption Carcach thinks his country needs. He says El Salvador is a lot like Japan or South Korea, small, centralized countries where it's easy to develop industries like tech. He says Salvadoran immigrants should study abroad and return home with new skills instead of working low-skilled jobs in the U.S.
They should prepare their kids to come here, especially when the U.S. is sending the message, look, we don't want you here.
But U.S. jobs still lure Salvadorans north. Despite his brother's death, even Vasquez says he dare to go to the U.S. again.
Sí, me atrevo a irme, pero con una persona que sí ya me lleve directamente hasta allá.
But only if he can afford to pay a smuggler to take him. In San Salvador, I'm Levi Bridges for Marketplace.
Finally, the U.S. is set to dominate global oil markets in the coming years, so says a report out today from the International Energy Agency. Over the next 3 years, production gains from the United States alone will cover 80% of the world's demand growth, thanks largely to the boom in U.S. shale oil production. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.